Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big.
It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with an audio adaptation of frightening fiction about jilted journeys. I'm your host, Paul J. McSorley, and tonight and every other Wednesday night, I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. I also wanted to take a moment to thank you all for your donations. We have reached our initial goal, but still need your help. Every share, donation, and comment of support helps. Let's keep building this together. Please go to helpchilling.org to share or contribute. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of Brett O'Reilly is myself, Paul J. McSorley, Olivia Steele, Otis Gyre, and Michelle Kane. Now get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our theater of the minds and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our tale this evening is written by Brett O'Reilly and performed by Paul J. McSorley, Olivia Steele, Otis Gyre, and Michelle Kane. In it, we meet a man heavily grieving the loss of his wife and daughter. And while some secrets are meant to go to the grave, that doesn't mean they'll stay buried. Now, without further ado, I present to you, Orpheus Wept. David closed the car door and sat in silence, staring out the windshield. A hollow man in a black suit. He had no tears left for the woman in the urn sealed in the columbarium not 30 feet away. Nothing for the smaller urn that shared the niche either. It wasn't that he didn't want to cry. It was simply, there was nothing left to give. So the sky wept for him. Briefly, he considered turning on the windshield wipers, then decided against it. The scattered procession of mourners outside were rain-streaked shadows. He was content to let them remain as such. It had been especially hard seeing Sarah's parents. Sarah had never been close to them. In fact, she had kept them at arm's length as much as possible for as long as he had known her. They, of course, had wanted otherwise. After all, she was their daughter. There had been no traumatic incident, no falling out between them. Not that David had ever learned of. Yet, Sarah kept her distance. Through their wedding, through Emily's birth, the only reason Carol and Mark even knew their granddaughter had been due to his own insistence. Things changed, though, after Emily's death. His own grief made it easier for Sarah to keep her distance from her parents. To see them now, to know their pain at the loss of their only child, a pain he knew all too well. They were out there somewhere now, shapes in the rain, locked out of his car, locked out of his heart. For now, at least. Night had fallen before he finally turned on the car and drove home. The rain continued. "Thank you, Carol," David spoke into the phone on the antique shop counter. I'll be there. Pause. Yes, I promise. Another pause. I love you too, Carol. Bye. He hung up, his mother-in-law doing the same on the other end. In the 2 years since Sarah's suicide, the bond between David and her parents had grown. Now, with his in-laws' 40th wedding anniversary a week away, he planned to drive up the coast and spend the weekend in the guest room, Sarah's old room. He couldn't help but be struck by the irony that in life, Sarah had always insisted they stay in a motel on those rare occasions they did visit. Outside came the low rumble of thunder, followed shortly by the soft patter of rain on the shop window. The last remnants of a dreary winter, voicing its displeasure that its time should be at an end. David looked out at the darkening evening, the shadows and water pooling in the streets flowing into the gutter like a river current. His mind began to wander, memories rising up unbidden. Emily skipped ahead, singing.
The toe bone's connected to the foot bone. Foot bone's connected to the ankle bone.
As David and Sarah meandered along down the trail holding hands. A pet would be good for her, David was saying, enjoying the fall sunshine. It would help teach her responsibility.
Really, David? Really?
Sarah sounded unconvinced.
And when it ends up being you or me taking the dog for a walk or cleaning the cat litter, that's teaching a 5-year-old responsibility?
Could always get a bird, David suggested.
Birds crap everywhere. Everywhere.
How about a hamster or a gerbil?
Are you seriously suggesting I let a rodent in my house?
David broke into a goofy smile. I love you.
Mm-hmm.
Came the response. They stepped out from the tree cover into open space, the river stretching out before them. Emily was already skipping onto the footbridge that spanned the river, having sung her way up to the hand bone. She stopped and turned, waving back to them.
Come on, Daddy! Hurry up!
David and Sarah started onto the bridge as Emily ran to the crest and climbed up the railing. Emily! David called out. No climbing on the railing! The river below looked calm, like a sheet of glass, but David knew a powerful current lurked under the surface. Emily didn't listen, but didn't climb any higher, choosing to wait for her parents. The two strode up, still holding hands. A few other people wandered the length of the bridge, enjoying the autumn air and the view of the river.
Daddy, look!
Emily pointed.
Boats!
David followed her aim down to the river near the far bank, where a group of teenagers were racing remote-controlled boats along the river's edge. Cool! David smiled as the miniature crafts shot across the water. Ferry speedboat races!
Daddy!
Emily berated him with a giggle.
Fairies don't race speedboats. Only sailboats.
David laughed. Let me get a picture. He began to rummage in his messenger bag for his iPhone as Emily climbed higher on the railing, leaning over, tracking one of the boats as it went under the bridge. He looked up in time to see her slip, falling headfirst over the railing, her mother unsuccessfully grabbing for her. Emily! David screamed, nearly throwing himself off the bridge after her. On the riverbank, the teenagers looked up, startled, then down again as Emily hit the water. Two stood in shock. The third reacted immediately, launching himself into the water and swimming out. David resisted the urge to jump the railing, knowing the current was too powerful. Instead, he bolted for the riverbank, searching the water for Emily as he ran. He spotted her as she emerged from under the bridge and was carried downstream, fighting to stay above the surface. Absently, he noticed the teen making his way back to shore, having gotten a taste of the current. One of his friends was moving to help him, the other running after Emily on the opposite bank. David flew down the riverside trail after his daughter. Behind him, Sarah stood on the bridge holding his messenger bag, both forgotten. David closed his eyes and breathed deeply, letting the memories fade back into the recesses of his mind. Emily had been gone 3 years longer than her mom, yet the memories remained strong. Even after 5 years, it didn't seem any easier. Reaching over, he locked the door to the shop and flipped the sign to closed. For a moment, he continued to look out at the rain-slick streets. Then with a sigh, he made his way through the shop, through the forgotten pieces of other people's lives, into the back where a new shipment of relics from some deceased soul's estate waited. An hour and a half later, after cataloging paintings, silverware, and jewelry, he found the chest. More of a footlocker than a chest, it was small and rectangular, the length and width of a board game box, but nearly a foot deep. The walls were a light wood, old but still solid, with tarnished brass fittings and latch. There was no lock. Flipping the latch, he raised the lid and blinked in wonder. Inside, to the rim, were stacked cylindrical leather scroll cases, the kind architects or artists might carry their life's work in. He peered into the locker, counting and calculating. 6 across, 3 deep, he guessed. 18 in all. David reached in and picked up the first case, hefted it. It felt like a leather case. Not exceptionally heavy either, possibly empty. His curiosity growing, he opened the case and glanced inside, then emptied the contents onto the floor in front of him. A single large sheet of vellum tied with a short cord spilled out of the leather tube. Pulling the knot, he rolled the vellum out and gave a low whistle at the sight before him. The map was stunning. It took him a moment to identify the location. The Brittany region of France. Not a geographer himself, he couldn't be sure of the map's accuracy. Then again, the cartographer himself had never been known for accuracy. His name, N. Defeur, was carefully inscribed near the top, on the right side. N. Defeur, Nicholas Defeur, 18th century cartographer and geographer for the Duke of Anjou in France. Nicholas Defeur, creator of over 600 maps, all beautifully drawn, many notoriously inaccurate. David had studied Defeur in college. In fact, old maps and cartography were his first love. They just didn't pay the bills as well as antiques. David carefully rolled and retied the vellum, placing it gingerly into its case, picked up another, opened it, untied and unrolled the vellum inside. Wales, 1708, N. Defeur. Another, Tuscany, 1692, N. Defeur. A dozen cases later, David sat back with a sigh. Every single case held a map of some region in Europe, each done in Defeur's masterful hand, and as such, wildly inaccurate. Of course, Defeur's work didn't have the cachet of, say, the Impressionists, but still, 18 maps. He figured the contents, once authenticated, to be worth at least $10,000. Quickly, he confirmed the contents of 2 more cases, Monaco and Bremen, but found himself hesitant to pick up the third and final case. Unsure as to his sudden reluctance, he reached into the chest and picked up the case, startled by its weight. It was at least a full pound heavier than the others. A sense of dread washed over him, a strange, inexplicable, yet certain subconscious knowledge that opening this one case would change everything. Everything. His fingers had opened the case before he knew what he was doing. This case was considerably different. Whereas the others had been simple, hollow leather tubes, this one was lined with velvet, such as might be used to protect a bottle of wine for transport. No bottle of wine or any other liquid floated in the case's depths. Instead, something metallic flashed in the light. David gently tilted the case, pouring the object into his hand. It was a puzzle device, a long cylinder with 5 alphabetized discs making a combination lock, like the kind used for bicycles. Though he had seen one before, he had only seen it at the movies. He had taken Sarah to see the Da Vinci Code on their second date, and such a device was a crucial plot point in the film. Turning this one over in his hands, he thought it seemed much bigger than the one in the movie. If he recalled correctly, the one Tom Hanks deciphered was only 6 inches long, whereas this one was nearly 2 feet. David stared at the cylinder, bewildered and fascinated. Its silvery surface was embossed with intertwined roses and lilies. He rolled the device over in his hands until he was staring at the engraved arrows that marked the starting position. In between the arrows, 5 letters spelled out S-A-R-A-H. Sarah's name stared up at him from the dials of the device. A cold chill didn't sweep through him so much as form everywhere at once. like a flash freeze. Five dials he didn't recall turning, if he had in fact turned them at all. Five letters that were there like magic. With hands shaking, he pulled on the ends of the device. Nothing moved. Disappointment, relief, and a sense of self-chastisement that he could be so silly all came out in a long exhale. He hadn't even realized he had been holding his breath, and a smile tugged at the corners of his mouth, a sardonic awareness of his own hubris.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Then the smile fell away as he found himself slowly turning the dials with his thumbs, a nearly imperceptible clicking accompanying each notch until the final letter locked into place. E-M-I-L-Y. David felt distant, disembodied as he looked down at his daughter's name. The feeling only intensified as he gently but firmly tugged on the ends of the device. He felt the outer shell separate from the inner core and carefully pulled out the device's interior. In an open metal sleeve, a single piece of vellum rested. Still seemingly watching himself from afar, hands unnaturally steady, he removed the sheet, set the device aside, and opened the vellum. He scanned its surface, confused, flipped the vellum over, flipped it back. The whole sheet was blank, both sides. David sat for a few minutes, working through why someone would go to the trouble of hiding a blank sheet of vellum in such a device. Eventually, he got up, sat down at his desk, an Edwardian roll top, and logged on to his laptop in search of some answers. The first thing he uncovered was that the device was called a cryptix. It was the invention of the Da Vinci Code author Dan Brown, which meant it didn't exist before 2003 outside of Mr. Brown's imagination, which helped explain why David, an antique dealer, wasn't familiar with the device. What it didn't explain was, based on the craftsmanship and apparent age, he would have placed it as having been crafted during Victorian times in the latter part of the 19th century. The second thing David looked up was invisible ink. Methods he had discovered included milk, white crayon, and baking soda. Lemon juice he had decided as being the most likely, as well as the easiest to detect. Still, considering the best heat source to reveal any lemon juice marks without damaging the vellum, he retrieved the sheet and stood in stunned silence. The vellum was no longer blank. A new map covered its surface from edge to edge, leaving David questioning whether he had imagined its absence in the first place. Placing it on the desk over the laptop, David spread the map out and studied it, his wonder and disbelief growing equally. The map was again a défaut. Though signed by what was unmistakably his hand, it was undated, which wasn't surprising, given that the map of the downtown core and Nicholas Défaut died in 1720. Downtown? The city hadn't even been established until Défaut was over a century in the grave. Simply put, it was a map that shouldn't exist. A forgery, perhaps. Most likely. David leaned back and rubbed his eyes with one hand. If this was a forgery, which it surely was, then likely the whole trunk was the same. A chest of elegantly crafted fakes. He opened his eyes and leaned forward again, intending to roll the map and return it to its case when something caught his eye. It was a small dot with a small inscription above it, the only location identified on the entirety of the map. The inscription said simply, "Shades." David suddenly felt disconnected from the world, as if he had shot past the signpost that read, "The Twilight Zone." It had been close to two decades ago that some college buddies had dragged him into Shades, an after-hours club tucked in a back alley in the downtown core. It was Halloween night, and he was dressed as Captain Jack Sparrow. His friends disappeared shortly after arrival to God knows where, and then he had met Sarah, magical in her Hermione Granger costume and feeling just as out of place as he was. That night, they became inseparable until her death. They tried many times to locate it over the years, to revisit the scene of their first encounter, but to no avail. It was like the club had been swallowed up by the earth itself. Now it was here, on a map. A map drawn by a man dead nearly 300 years. David looked at the inscription above Defer's signature. Suivez le désir de ton cœur. Follow the desire of your heart. He sat for over an hour, trying to reason and rationalize through his discovery. If it was a forgery, it was an exceptionally specific one, tailored especially for him, with information that very few knew, aside from himself and Sarah. And she. After further contemplation, he returned the map to the cryptics to its case, then slid the case into the messenger bag Sarah had bought him for their third wedding anniversary. Grabbing his keys off a hook, he strode out the shop's back door, locking it behind him on his way downtown. Forgery or not, he had to know. The words kept ringing in his head. Suivez le désir de ton cœur. It seemed like pure fantasy. Still, he had to know. The trip downtown took just under an hour. David parked the car in an open pay-by-the-hour lot a block away from the alley on the map. He had checked and rechecked the map a dozen times on the way, half fearing he'd find the map had changed again, back to its blank slate or into another 18th century slice of Europe a la Der Führer. It hadn't changed. Reaching into the back seat for his messenger bag, he absently noted Emily's booster seat, quiet and still in the car's interior light. One of a thousand reminders of her he had never had the heart to part with. Carefully adjusting the bag on his shoulder, its cargo sticking out one end, he closed the car door, hit the alarm, and walked away. He soon found himself staring at a Greek restaurant's rear facade, dark gray and so nondescript as to be nearly indistinguishable from the clouds above. On either side of him, empty alleys led to quiet streets. Before him, an exterior stairwell led down into darkness, its presence marked only by a dully lit red neon sign. Thankfully, the rain had stopped. He again shifted the messenger bag on his shoulder, feeling the weight of the leather case and the cryptics it contained. Uneasy and unsure of himself, he descended the stairs to the club's entrance. Above him, neon flickered, a red splash against the otherwise featureless wall. The letter S at the beginning appeared to have long since burned out. At the bottom of the stairwell sat a simple steel door. He reached for the handle, then paused. A month ago, if asked, he would not have been able to describe the door in much detail, let alone what lay immediately beyond. Now he recognized every scratch in the steel's paint, etched graffiti standing out like wards against the outer world, or perhaps to contain what lay within. On the other side, he knew, was a stool on which the doorman sat, though that hulking figure remained a vague shape in David's memory. Of course, this many years later, it would be a new face, a new figure on the stool. Past the club's guardian ran a long hall sided with wood paneling, hers and his washrooms set on either side. At the end of the hall, a heavy oak door gave way to a switchback of stairs. None up, only down, descending a few floors to the club, which resided in an enlarged section of the old smuggler's tunnels left over from Prohibition days. All this he remembered, but not beyond, not the club itself. David grasped the door handle and pulled. The door clicked as it swung open. He stepped through. Bare incandescent bulbs flared to life down the paneled hall, ending before the old oaken door. The stool by the door had changed. Formerly solid wood, it was now a black steel frame with a vinyl upholstered top, also in black. The stool was unoccupied, as was the hall. There was no sign of who had turned on the lights. He shuddered as he looked at the empty stool. Suddenly, the wall seemed very close, the door at the end of the hall very far away. His eyes locked on that far door. For some unknown reason, the faces of his long-lost wife and daughter floated to the forefront of his mind. Emily, Sarah, he said to himself, his conscious mind not fully comprehending the words. I'm coming. With a sudden resolve, he strode down the hall to the oak door and the stairs beyond. I don't remember there being this many stairs, David panted out loud, leaning against a wall. What were supposed to be a few flights had turned into several. Minutes had seemingly turned into hours. At least that's what it felt like. His watch had stopped, at best guess, around midnight when he had first entered the building. At this point, he was just thankful he could see his watch. At every landing, a single unwavering light bulb shed illumination. The thought of being caught in the stairwell in absolute darkness was something he didn't want to consider. Heaving himself off the wall, David continued his downward spiral, past old torn posters of forgotten bands with names like Dead Alley Cats in Heat and Dog Bite. Almost as an afterthought, he realized he had seen no one. Not in the hall, not at any point in the stairwell. Then again, it was an after-hours club. Maybe no one had arrived yet? He continued on. After another 10 flights, or was it 20, or more, he finally found himself in front of a door, oak like its bookend above. With a deep breath, he turned the knob and pulled, then stepped through into the chamber beyond. The walls were built of faded brick, nearly a century old. A vaulted ceiling, supported by seemingly ancient wooden beams, rose out of sight above. Five passageways, tunnels, led in different directions, each one lit by actual torches in sconces. A handful of identical torches lit the chamber itself. He couldn't help but ponder whether the licking flames were a fire hazard, whether or not brick could burn. Somewhere in the distance, he could hear the sound of rushing water, its distant echo taking him back to another time, another search. David raced along the riverbank, desperately scanning for signs of Emily in the current. On the opposite bank, he could see the young man mirroring his efforts. The water was faster here, just shy of being rapids, and David was terrified that she was underneath it somewhere, snagged, lost to him forever. His breath was ragged from running, and his legs had gone beyond pain to a numb ache. Suddenly, he stumbled and flew forward, driving into dirt and gravel and weeds. Small clouds of dry dirt flew up, mixing with his tears to form mud. He struggled to regain his feet, to continue the pursuit of his precious daughter, to rescue his Emily. His body seemed to have betrayed him, however, his muscles burning, refusing to push him to his feet. A racking sob caught in his chest as the horrible truth coalesced in his brain. He had lost her. It was over. David felt reality lurch back into place, found himself on his hands and knees on the floor of the chamber. His second trip down memory lane in less than 24 hours, only this one felt like more than a memory. It was like as if he had actually been there again. Throat closed, heart still pounding from a long-ago desperate chase down a distant river's path. Starting to pick himself up, he noticed the leather case lying a few feet away, having fallen out of his messenger bag. Fearfully, he scrambled over and scooped it up, checking the case, then the cryptics for damage. Nothing seemed harmed. To be on the safe side, he slid the interior of the cryptics out and checked the map. What he saw stopped him cold. The vellum was unmarred by its tumble, having been safe inside multiple layers. At the top, near the left-hand side, Nicholas Defer's signature remained, as did the inscription above it. The map, however, had changed. Again. Instead of the downtown center of the city, a network of catacombs was displayed. The large chamber he was currently sprawled in was evident at the bottom of the map. Near the upper left corner was a heart-shaped mark at the end of a corridor. David could only conclude that was his destination. Which, given the complex layout of the tunnels, he would never find without assistance. He provides, David thought to himself, then shuddered at the thought. Who is he? Returning the cryptics to its container and it to his messenger bag, David began tracing his way through the brick passages, map in hand and held out in front of him. The journey was slow and lonely, even though he soon found himself not alone. Others wandered the tunnels, mostly young partygoers, 20-somethings looking for a good time, many who seemed to have already found it. Even as he felt a sense of distaste at the young couples or groups who stumbled by him, he found himself reminded that he had once been one of them, in fact, stumbling through these very tunnels, looking very much like the clubbers he was encountering. The thought made him feel old. Along the path, deep in the maze, he found a middle-aged woman staggering through the halls, calling someone's name and apologizing. She seemed panicked, not inebriated, and David found her apparent search disturbing and far too familiar. He paused for a moment, thinking to offer help. However, the woman looked at him tearfully, said, "I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to look. Barbara!" before racing haphazardly down another passage. Though thankfully brief, the encounter left him chilled to the bone. At last, he came to a massive set of oaken doors which were carved with a giant symbol resembling a cross topped with a bowl or crescent, a circle or moon sitting above the crescent. Some deep part of David's subconscious recognized the symbol but refused to relay the information to his conscious mind. He thought of the old inscription that Defer's predecessors wrote on the unexplored sections of maps. "Here be dragons." Somehow it seemed fitting, and for a moment he considered turning around, finding his way home, back to his bed, where he would wake up and know all of this for the dream it was. Instead, he pushed to open the doors and stepped through. He walked into an onslaught of sight and sound. A rainbow of strobe lights bounced off the undulating masses before him, dancers in day-glow and denim writhing to an 80s remix, the voice unquestionably Dennis DeYoung's. He had found the club proper. Absently noting the non-presence of any doorman, he secured the map in its velvet-lined home, then pushed into the crowd, checking faces as he worked his way through the room. The club seemed cavernous, with no walls or ceiling in sight. All the faces he looked at seemed nondescript, generic, certainly none that looked like Sarah, or Emily for that matter. He pushed on. After being jostled by the crowd for what felt like an immeasurable time, he found himself on the edge of a canal cut into the floor of the club. Clearly a remnant of Prohibition days when the tunnels and chambers hosted rum runners and bootleggers. A low fog now hung over the underground waterway, obscuring the far side from view. The canal itself still held water, a half a foot below the edge, a slow current barely detectable. No apparent way across, though he had a foreboding suspicion as to how that might be achieved. He certainly wasn't about to swim it. Even if he was willing to get wet, who knew if there was a current, or where he might eventually land.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
"There! There!"
The young man across the river was practically screaming, pointing at a spot ahead on David's side. David pulled himself to his feet as a couple caught up to him and took a few steps forward, straining to see what the young man was pointing at. It took a minute to see. A tree, fallen into the river from some unknown locale upstream, now lodged in a shallow section of the river. There, in its branches, a small dash of purple. Emily's jacket.
"David!"
Sarah called out from behind, in the distance.
"David!"
"She's there, Sarah!"
David yelled back as he began to run again. "Over there!" He hit the water, half swimming, half running, fighting against a shallow but still strong current. Then he was at the tree, fighting through the branches, trying to reach Emily.
"David!"
Sarah called from the bank, an edge in her voice, a tension he felt in his entire body. Emily was face down when he got to her, jacket ballooning around her limp body. He pulled her free of the branches and scooped her up,
frantically saying her name. Emily, Emily, wake up, Emily. Please, Pumpkin, wake up. He was so intent on her that he didn't notice the couple pulling them out of the water. Nor Sarah, standing to one side, her face a blank canvas, looking on. It was nearly an hour before the paramedics arrived. David never stopped trying. 30 compressions to two breaths. 30 to two. 30 to two. Emily never woke up. David slipped out of the memory, unsteady but still standing. Even as the image of Emily's lifeless body slipped away, he found himself troubled, as if in all these recollections he had missed something. Something important. Suddenly, a figure appeared before him, which was disconcerting, given he was facing directly over the canal. It took him a heartbeat to realize the figure was standing in a boat, a gondola, dark wood and red velvet seats, like those that made Venice famous. His second impression was of height, though standing some 6 inches below him, the figure was above eye level to David's 6'2" frame. His third impression was of a large, voluminous, hooded black robe which completely cloaked the figure's features. Coldness swept through him. To this point, it had all seemed a bit like a game, a fantastic, surreal game mysteriously orchestrated by a long-dead cartographer. Now, facing the boatman, the boatman, everything snapped into a focus that was too real. Any remaining doubt dissipated as a skeletal hand stretched out toward him, palm upturned. The hand seemed to float in the air, almost separate from its owner. David swallowed deeply as he realized his predicament.
I only have credit.
He managed to stumble out the words, pulling out his wallet and starting to rifle through it, looking for any forgotten bills or coins. He froze in horror as the hand extended towards his. His horror doubled as one long ivory finger tapped on the wedding ring he hadn't had the will to remove in 2 years, even as its mate lay in an urn in a columbarium in a world far removed. Tap, tap, tap. The finger tapped the ring 3 times before reassuming its open palm position. He gave the boatman a pleading look.
No, no. There must be something else. Something. It's all I have of...
He stopped. Of course, it was all he had of her, of Sarah. And now he was to trade it for Sarah. For Sarah and Emily. With a shaking hand, he slowly twisted the ring off his finger and placed it in the bony outstretched palm. Calcified digits closed on the gold band in a slow, unnerving manner, then deposited it into a deep fold of the robe. A slow wave invited David to board the gondola. He did so. The gondola pulled away from the canal's edge and glided across the water without a ripple in its wake. The fog closed in around the craft, muting the sounds of the club. David found himself alone with his thoughts and the boatman. He strained to recall the story of Orpheus, the Greek hero who had gone into the underworld to bring his wife back from the dead. Had Orpheus paid Charon in gold? No, in music. Orpheus had been a minstrel. He had charmed the boatman with his music and sung Cerberus, the three-headed dog, to sleep. David's eyes widened. A three-headed dog. That was a problem. Even if he had an instrument, he wasn't much of a musician. He certainly couldn't imagine anything else he was carrying that would appease a three-headed mastiff. Aside from his own leg, perhaps. The gondola pulled up alongside an edge. David couldn't even be sure it wasn't the same one they had just left. He climbed out and said thank you to the boatman, who simply bowed its head and waited. That's a good sign, David thought to himself. He's waiting. Pensively, he stepped away from the boat and boatman and surveyed the scene before him. As on the other side of the canal, a sea of people floated before him. Unlike their turbulent counterparts, the dancers here seemed stationary, swaying gently to some music playing only in their heads. The silence seemed perfect, only broken by David's breathing. Only his breathing. He jolted at the realization, studied the faces nearest him. An old man, eyes closed, jaw slack, softly swaying. A woman in her early 20s, gently rocking, expressionless. A middle-aged man, bamboo in the wind, just like the others. All were dressed in gray, an odd counterpart to the fluorescent fashions on the Far Side's dance floor. He took a step forward, stopped as the two men closest to him stepped away. He took another step, and two more people moved. Only a step, no more. Clearing a path. Another step, and another. Without a whisper, the crowd parted for him, a few at a time, allowing him passage through. Each step took him deeper until he found himself standing in front of a simple wooden door set into a brick wall. On the door was mounted a large brass knocker in the shape of three snarling mastiff heads, the center head clenching a large brass ring in its teeth. Tentatively, as if afraid of being bitten, David reached up, lifted the ring, and brought it down. Once, twice, thrice. A moment's silence, followed by a click. The door opened an inch, no more. David paused for a heartbeat before entering. David blinked at the brightness, his eyes taking a moment to adjust to the fluorescent lights overhead. To his right, a ribbon of red laminate counter stretched the length of the room. To his left, back-to-back of faux leather booths in the same red ran along the wall below windows that looked into blackness. He couldn't help but catch his breath. It was the diner where Sarah told him she was pregnant with Emily. He stood there, legs unsteady, absorbing the scene. The tin-topped glass salt and pepper shakers, the mini jukeboxes are stationed at the back end of each table. The tall glass-enclosed pie rack at midpoint on the counter, the shelves slowly rotating to display their wares. At the far end of the diner, a woman, dark-haired, olive skin, sitting at a booth watching him. Across from her, backs to him, another woman sat, beside her, a girl. Their frames were hauntingly familiar.
Stop!
David froze after three hurried steps into the diner. He turned to look at the man who had spoken. Slim, also dark-haired and olive-skinned, wearing a tailored blue suit, a coffee cup raised in one hand, the other raised in a halting gesture. The man took a sip from his cup before gesturing to the chrome and red faux leather stool beside him.
Please, sit.
The man's voice was deep and smooth, the accent Mediterranean. It left no room for argument. David sat down as the man slid another cup of coffee in front of him. He glanced at the far end booth. The dark-haired woman gave him a gentle smile. Her companions didn't move.
Hello, Mr. Harper.
The man spoke, extending a hand.
It's a pleasure to meet you. I've heard much about you.
The last said with a nod toward the booth. David shook the man's hand. The grip was firm without being overbearing. It was also ice cold, though not painfully so. David was suddenly struck by the surrealness of it all. His journey through the city, down the endless stairs and through the tunnels, the club, the canal, and now this. David hesitated. It's not what I expected. The man smiled, amused, with no hint of malice.
You were expecting massive stone walls? A great black throne. A craggy bearded face.
The man chuckled.
The journey's a little different for everyone, as is the final meeting place.
He gestured around the diner.
As for me...
The man slowly shook his head in mock sadness.
Everyone seems to forget in the end, I'm Greek.
David couldn't help but smile. A glance at the booth turned his smile pensive. The man noticed.
Mr. Harper, may I call you David?
David nodded.
Well, thank you, David. Now, tell me, why are you here?
David found himself a bit confused by the question. Why was he here? I found a map. The man took a sip of his coffee.
You found a map? This map. Where does it lead?
David had to stop and think again. Where did it lead? He thought of how it had changed from a blank sheet to the downtown core to the labyrinth outside. Then he remembered the inscription. It leads...
It leads to my heart's desire. The man raised an eyebrow.
David, are you sure about that?
David paused for a moment, eyeing the two figures at the booth with their backs to him, then nodded with absolute conviction. Yes, yes, I am. The man smiled.
Good, good, David. I'm very happy to hear that. You see, David, Orpheus was the first. He was far from the last. You are the latest. All of this.
The man gestured around again.
And what you saw just outside the door isn't the end, the final destination. It's more of a holding area for those souls not ready or capable of moving on.
The man took a sip of coffee. David followed suit, more out of politeness than actual want. Black, two sugars, perfect temperature. It only added to the unrealness of the situation. The man continued.
Some of the souls that land here don't belong. The reason they don't move on is because they weren't ready to leave in the first place.
He looked at the far end booth. David followed his gaze to the dark-haired woman, who was smiling back affectionately.
She'll leave shortly after you do,
the man said, still looking across the diner.
I only have her here for 3 months. 3 months a year. Not the 6, most believe.
The man turned back, took another sip of his coffee.
All the myths paint me as a monster, a rapist, a kidnapper, a tyrant. After all, what's the quote? History is written by the victors.
A shadow of heartbreak flitted across the man's face so quickly David almost missed it.
The dark, forbidding lord of the underworld. Yet I know all too well what it's like to lose the one you love, for I must do so every year.
He turned to David.
David, you may take your wife and daughter with you when you leave. You have my blessing to do so. However, I must warn you, there are rules. Rules that even I may not bend or break. As with Orpheus and all those who have come after him, you must not look back until you stand in the light of day. To look upon them, either of them, will doom them to remain here forever. As my guest, such as it is. Do you understand, David Harper?
David numbly nodded. The image of the woman in the tunnels, calling for Barbara, leaped to mind. He felt his body grow cold. The man smiled and offered his hand again. Again, David shook it, noticing it felt considerably warmer.
Oh, before you go, I'll need my map back.
The man extended his hand once again, albeit with a different purpose this time around. Of course. David fumbled with the messenger bag, nearly dropping the cryptics on the floor before placing it in the man's hand. The thought of attempting to navigate the maze of tunnels without assistance brought to mind another myth. Theseus and the Minotaur. Worriedly, he wondered if he might find a length of string in the labyrinth that would lead him home.
Go now, my friend. Remember, don't look back. Not until you stand in sunlight.
With a last glance at the booth at the far end and the two figures with their backs to him, David turned to leave. As he did, the man spoke once more.
David, sometimes what the heart wants is not what the mind thinks it is. Please remember that.
A pause.
Good luck.
Without looking back again, David walked out of the diner and back into the sea of lost souls. Every step to the canal was a struggle. He had come through the door and heard it close behind him. He had not heard it reopen, nor did he hear footsteps behind. All he had to go on was faith alone. Faith that they were following behind. Faith that Sarah and Emily were right there. David wasn't sure faith was enough. He came to the canal's edge where the boatman waited. For a moment, he felt a surge of panic with the thought that he had no other payment for the boatman. However, that was dispelled as a skeletal hand waved him on board. He sat at the bow, careful to keep his eyes fixed on the fog-shrouded waters. The gondola slowly arced toward the far shore, too quickly, David thought, for anyone else to have boarded.
It was only with immense effort he kept his gaze locked forward. The other side was quiet as a tomb. No music, no lights, no revelers. Disembarking, he almost turned to thank the boatman but caught himself. Instead, he simply said, "Thank you," and crossed the floor to the torch-lit passageway and beyond. His fears of being lost in the maze were quickly dispelled. Only one set of corridors was lit, and he moved quickly and easily through them. He worried he was moving too fast, yet was fearful that if he delayed, his faith would waver. He would turn to look and lose all. For the same reason, he didn't speak, in case the sound of his own voice, unanswered, would be too much to bear. And so he walked on through the old smuggler's catacombs to the main chamber, then up, up the countless flights of stairs, all in silence. David stopped at the door at the top of the stairs, his hands on the handle. With a deep breath, he closed his eyes, leaned his forehead against the polished oak, and spoke. "I don't know if you're actually there. I don't even know if this is just a dream or a hallucination, some delusion I've brought down on myself. What I do know is that I have missed you both so much. Every day without you, my heart hurts. I would do anything to get you back." David couldn't help but smile a little. "Even enter the depths of Hades." He lifted his head up, eyes fixed on the oak. "Beyond this door is a hallway and one last door. We're going to walk all the way, into sunlight, together again." David pulled the door open, and with more conviction than he had ever known in his life, David strode down the hall. As he reached the final door, his hand closed on the last handle, a single word echoed through the hall.
"Stop!"
David froze, closed his eyes. "Sarah?"
"David, stop. Look at me."
"Sarah, I can't. If I do, the rules..." Confusion with a touch of panic permeated David's voice.
"David."
Sarah's voice held a note of sadness and tired frustration.
"David, listen to me. Just listen."
David, with his eyes sealed, listened.
"David, what you've done, finding us like this, it's very heroic. I know you love us, both of us, so much."
A heartbeat passed. Two.
"But David, I don't love you."
David felt an icicle spear his heart. Cold trails spread throughout his body, through arteries and veins. The empty space that had carried his wedding band began to ache.
"What I mean is..."
Sarah's voice sighed.
"What I mean is, I don't love you in the same way you love me. I never really did. Not in the way you love."
Another pause.
"And I don't love Emily. Not the way you do."
David felt his head swim. It wasn't true. None of what she was saying was true. It was a trick to make him turn around. Or a test, one final test of his faith. He had to be strong. He reached again for the door.
"David, remember that day on the bridge? The day Emily died."
Again, he felt chilled to the core. There was something there, something he didn't want to see, didn't want to remember. He tried to push the memories away, just to open the door and step out, have his family back, live their own happily ever after.
"David, remember. Remember the bridge. Remember when Emily was standing on the railing? She climbed up, even though you told her not to. She leaned over."
"Let me get a picture," David said, rummaging in his messenger bag for his iPhone as Emily climbed higher on the railing, leaning over as she tracked one of the boats sailing under the bridge. He looked up in time to see her slip just a little, and Sarah's hand not trying to pull her back, but giving a little push. A push, pushing her over. For a split second, David saw someone else standing there on the bridge, a stranger wearing his wife's face. A stranger he had seen in brief glimpses before, but always convinced himself it was just his imagination. Reality was slow to reassert itself. David clung to the steel door, its solidity an anchor, countering the weakness in his body. His breath came out in a jagged whisper. Sarah. She spoke.
I never wanted her, David. I never wanted her. I never wanted any child. I only had her for you. Because you wanted her so bad. Then when you had her, having her made you so happy, I couldn't. I just couldn't.
David could hear the strain in her voice.
David, there were so many times I almost did it. Before that day, so many moments when the only thing that stopped me was the phone ringing or you walking into the room. 5 years of almost. And then it wasn't almost. It was.
Something deep inside David broke. He gave a heaving sob. Sarah continued.
The problem was it just made it worse. It was like before, you were devoted to her. Suddenly, you were obsessed. It was like she was everywhere to you. Everything reminded you of her. For two goddamn years, you couldn't let go.
David could hear the frantic edge in her voice. His own throat felt hoarse and dry, even as tears ran unabashedly down his face.
You couldn't let go, David. So I did.
David sank to his knees, head bowed. His tears ceased. All emotion drained away, leaving a hollow shell behind.
Only you still couldn't let go.
Her voice took on an accusatory tone.
That's why we're here now, because you couldn't let go.
David felt the cold metal of the door against his forehead, his mind at a complete loss for words. The silence stretched out in the hall, dark and heavy, before Sarah spoke again.
You need to let go, David. I don't want to be here. But I don't want to be with you. Or her. You can have her. Be that happy little family you want so much. But without me. I need you to let me go.
David sat there, slumped in the hallway for endless moments, picking his way through his late wife's words, sorting, comprehending, deciding. Eventually, he turned his head and opened his eyes to look at Sarah one last time. Carefully mindful of the rules, ready to turn away at even the slightest hint of Emily. Sarah stood at the far end of the hall, expressionless.
Goodbye, David.
Was all she said. Then she was gone, as if she never was. David quickly turned back to the door, took a deep breath, and another. Eventually, he slowly, stiffly rose and turned the handle, pulled the door open, stepped into the concrete stairwell. Grayish light filled the air. Somewhere above, a flap of wings announced a pigeon returning to its roost. Beyond that, the muted sounds of traffic reached his ears. Dawn was slowly returning to the city. Steadily, David climbed the stairs and walked out of the alley onto a still quiet street. Warm sunlight touched his cheek, though spring was still weeks away. He closed his eyes and lifted his face to the sun, enjoying the heat. As he did so, a small, delicate hand slipped into his. Tears began to weave down once again. This time, though, his hurting heart hurt in a very different way.
Daddy?
A small voice spoke up, hesitantly. David broke into a smile. Emily. He looked down at the little girl holding his hand. She was unchanged. Still 5 years old, even after 7 in the grave. I've missed you. Emily's pensiveness gave way to simple, unadulterated joy.
I missed you too, Daddy.
David swept his daughter into his arms and hugged her tightly. Minutes passed before he released her to look at her. There would be questions he didn't have the answers to. Little girls didn't come back from the dead. Yet, here she was, his Emily, still 5 years old. You have great timing, Pumpkin. Granny and Grandpa are going to be so excited to see you. Still carrying her in his arms, David walked to his car. Suddenly thankful, he had never had the heart to remove her booster from the back seat. I hope you enjoyed Orpheus Wept, as written by Brett O'Reilly and performed by Paul J. McSorley, Olivia Steele, Otis Gyre, and Michelle Kane. Tonight's tale comes from Brett O'Reilly's book called Aftertaste. Check out this book and more by visiting www.veloxbooks.com. That's VELOXBOOKS.com. On to the shows. Longtime resident Otis Gyre has his very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. We also have Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Fridays, featuring some Southern down-home horror. And don't forget to check out the Fear from the Heartland archives, featuring more than 120 episodes. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us tonight and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host of the evening, Paul J. McSorley, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.